Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
On the case of the January 6th pipe bomber, what did they find to make an arrest nearly 5 years after the crime? We talk with a counterterrorism specialist in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, San Francisco teachers authorize a strike. West Contra Costa teachers keep striking.
A federal vaccine advisory committee was expected to vote against longstanding vaccine advice. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Instead, members sniped at each other and said they did not understand what they were voting on. Also, President Trump will be at the FIFA World Cup drawing today. Why has he spent so much time at men's sporting events this year? It's Friday, December 5th. This day in 1933, Utah ratified the 21st Amendment, ending the constitutional ban on alcohol in the United States. Cheers. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Several top lawmakers from both parties got new details yesterday about a U.S. military strike on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean last September. There are questions about a second strike on the boat that killed survivors of the first attack. Several Republican lawmakers say they support the Trump administration's effort to stop drug trafficking, although no evidence has been released to show who the people are. Connecticut Democratic Congressman Jim Himes saw the video of the military strike. He says these are suspects and potential criminals.
Killing people who we have traditionally arrested and interdicted is both stupid, because if you kill them, you can't interview them to find out who their bosses are, what the transshipment points are, what the routes are. You know, these are criminals. They are not terrorists. Terrorists have a political and a strategic objective. Narco-traffickers, as hideous as they are simply trying to sell a product to Americans.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The congressional gerrymandering fight for next year's midterm elections is over for Texas. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing the state to use its recently redrawn map that could help Republicans keep control of the House of Representatives. But as NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, the redistricting fight continues in other states.
In California, a federal court is set to hold a hearing this month on whether to block a congressional map that could help Democrats pick up 5 more U.S. House seats. California voters approved that map to counter the new Texas map that President Trump pushed for to help Republicans win 5 additional House seats. Missouri's Republican-friendly map is facing lawsuits and a referendum effort. New maps may be coming in Florida, Indiana, New York, and Virginia. And another wave of congressional gerrymandering may be on its way, depending on what and when the Supreme Court decides in a Louisiana case. During a rare second round of oral arguments for that case in October, the court's conservative majority appeared inclined to weaken the Voting Rights Act's long-standing protections against racial discrimination in redistricting. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning amid news of a blockbuster entertainment deal. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 160 points in early trading.
Netflix appears to have won the bidding war to buy the studio and streaming business of Warner Brothers Discovery for $72 billion. The deal would allow Netflix to produce more programs in the U.S. and give the streaming service access to Warner Brothers' vast catalog of movies and TV shows. The deal does not include Warner Discovery's cable networks, such as CNN and TBS. Netflix beat out rival bidders Comcast and Paramount. Cloud computing provider Cloudflare says it's resolved a problem with its firewall that was disrupting global traffic on sites like Zoom and LinkedIn. It's the second major outage for the company in 3 weeks. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up more than 170 points. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Francisco teachers have voted to authorize a strike after months of labor negotiations with the school district. The vote is the first of two needed before the United Educators of San Francisco can start a work stoppage over wages and health care coverage. UESF's Natalie Reese says more than 99% of the members who voted approved a strike.
We hope district management is, you know, really looking at where they're at in negotiations and preparing to bring us, you know, things that could be a potential agreement, because no one wants to strike, but we are willing to win the necessary things we're fighting for.
The district says it gave teachers large raises in 2023 and is currently working under state fiscal oversight as it heads off a massive budget deficit. Pamela Price is running for district attorney in Alameda County just a year after she was recalled from the position. The progressive prosecutor was overwhelmingly ousted last November amid complaints of high crime and allegations of incompetence and misconduct in her office. Speaking Thursday, Price said she was forced out by a small group of wealthy elites who opposed her progressive policies.
Alameda County wants real justice that does not bend for wealth, status, or political connections. I will be the district attorney who puts people first.
During her tenure, Price launched a division to investigate police misconduct and filed resentencing motions in dozens of death row cases after evidence of prosecutorial bias surfaced. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus on a Friday morning at 7:06, checking bridge brake lights and delays. Good morning, Mel Baker.
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of brake lights on 580 westbound as you come toward the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, beginning at the Richmond Parkway. It's just crawling along. The same on the Bay Bridge. The backup is just really pretty tremendous. Also, barely moving, westbound 80 begins to back up around Powell Street. As you come into the maze, 580 is starting to bunch up, and also 880. It is slow across the span after Treasure Island, but not as bad as it was earlier, but it remains that way all the way through San Francisco. 101 northbound in San Francisco from the 280 merge up to the hospital curve is slow. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. More traffic with Mel in about 10 minutes time from now. Clear to partly cloudy, chilly temperatures this morning. Areas of frost and patchy, possibly dense fog as well. Then becoming sunny the rest of the day. Bay Area highs today, mid-50s to low 60s. Similar conditions for Sacramento. Highs across the southern Sacramento Valley, 50 to 57. 7:07 at KQED News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we visit the hometowns of two West Virginia National Guard members who were shot while on duty in Washington. We begin with an arrest in a crime in Washington 5 years ago.
The night before a mob of President Trump's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of 2021, somebody placed two pipe bombs outside the Republican and Democratic National Party headquarters, which are nearby.
For almost 5 years, the FBI tried to find the culprit, but came up empty until Thursday, when the Justice Department announced that federal agents had arrested a 30-year-old man suspected of planting those devices.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering this, and he's with us now. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
So what can you tell us about this person who's now in custody, and what's he charged with?
Well, his name is Brian Cole Jr. He is, as you guys mentioned, 30 years old. He was arrested in Woodbridge, Virginia, which is about 20 or so miles south of D.C. Court papers say that he lives there with his mom and that he works in the office of a bail bondsman in Northern Virginia. Now, as for the charges, he's charged with transporting an explosive device with intent to kill, as well as attempted malicious destruction with explosive materials. Those are the charges as of this morning, but officials said yesterday that this is still very much an active investigation and prosecutors could bring more charges down the road.
So for almost 5 years, the FBI has been trying to find the person who planted these bombs. Did officials say yesterday what, after all this time, led them to Cole?
Right. This has been a massive investigation to try to solve this mystery over the years. And remember, these pipe bombs didn't go off on January 6th, but they did draw police away from the Capitol that day, the day that rioters stormed the building. Now, officials said yesterday it wasn't a new tip that broke this case open. Here's Attorney General Pam Bondi speaking to reporters yesterday.
Let me be clear. There was no new tip. There was no new witness. Just good, diligent police work and prosecutorial work.
Now, FBI Director Kash Patel said the Bureau brought in a new team of investigators and experts to re-examine all of the evidence that the FBI had collected over the past 4+ years. And that new team sifted through all of the data, and Patel said that's what led to new investigative leads, including a critical forensic lead, he said. And ultimately, the road led to Cole.
What evidence do the prosecutors have that allegedly ties Cole to these pipe bombs?
Well, an FBI affidavit says that records of financial transactions show that Cole bought items that were the same as the components used to build the pipe bombs that were found. So galvanized pipes, end caps used to close the ends of the pipe bombs, steel wool, the same kind of white kitchen timers and red-black electrical wires. There's also cell phone location data that shows that Cole's cell phone was pinging cell towers in the area where the pipe bombs were left on the night that they were placed there. And then the affidavit says that a license plate reader picked up Cole's car getting off the interstate near the Capitol on the evening of January 5th, just in a half hour or so before the bombs were put in place.
Now, people might remember there have been a lot of conspiracy theories about these pipe bombs, who left them, why. Now that the suspect is in custody, do we know anything about the motive or whether these bombs were connected to the attack on the Capitol?
Well, those really are the million-dollar questions, and unfortunately, no. At this point, we don't know answers to those. Ironically, one of the conspiracy theories that was out there, that the pipe bombs were an inside job by the FBI, that was pushed by Dan Bongino when he was a podcaster. Dan Bongino is now the deputy director of the FBI, and he got a lot of credit yesterday for this arrest. Now, Cole is expected to appear in court here in D.C. later today, and answers to a lot of these outstanding questions are most likely to come in court over the weeks and months to come as the Justice Department prosecutes this case.
That's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Phil Mudd has been listening to Ryan with us. Mr. Mudd served as Deputy Director of the CIA Counterterrorist Center and also Deputy Director of the FBI National Security Branch. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
What do you make of the assertion that the FBI received no new evidence, just had better analysis of whatever evidence they had?
Boy, this is a new world story with an old world answer. That is, in the days when everybody's talking about AI and jobs being replaced by AI, you bring in a different set of people, and a human brain can ask a different set of questions. Sometimes when you're working on a case for years, you get tunnel vision. Remember back in the anthrax case initially, back in the early 2000s after 9/11, people thought at the FBI there was an initial suspicion around a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
The team changed on that investigation, and the investigation turned as a result. So my point is, you can look at data all day long, but when you bring in a different mind that looks at it a different way, sometimes you get different answers, and that might have happened in this case.
So you're thinking this is like one of those TV programs where somebody comes upon a cold case and just thinks about it differently?
I wouldn't call this a cold case, because I've heard that term in the past few days, but the prominence of this case means that people we're looking at it over the years. So I think that asking different questions is an important part of why the case cracked. But I would also add, in the age of AI, looking at this amount of data is very, very difficult. You're talking about phone data. You're talking about purchases from big box stores of things like end caps. You're talking about license plate readers. Aggregating thousands, tens of thousands of bits of data has also accelerated in the past few years, and I suspect that helped as well.
That is a thing that I wondered about, because I'm aware that national security agencies work with companies such as Palantir. I haven't heard their name specifically in this case, but they're all about more and more advanced data analysis. And my first guess was that that's what's different from 5 years ago, is that it is easier to analyze this data more thoroughly.
You are the first person to ask that question. I think that is what was missing in the press conference. There was a lot of conversation about nothing new came to the table. Think of how much we've talked about digital data acquisition and sort of analysis in the last 5 years, and how much it's changed. Even in the past, say, 24 months, 12 months, the conversations about how basic jobs will be replaced by AI. My point is, I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect over the past 5 years, the duration of this investigation, that the ability to massage huge amounts of data changed. And so even though there are humans asking different questions, their ability to get a rapid response really changes when you have that kind of data analysis at your fingertips.
Now let's talk about the suspect himself, and we're going into an area here where it's going to be hard to have a data-based answer. Brian Cole Jr., we just heard, 30 years old, lived with his mom. How do you go about trying to establish the why, the motive for this, if in fact he did it?
Well, there's two answers to that. You can do that by obviously talking to the subject, and the initial reports are that he is talking. You've obviously got access to the family. He was a gamer, so I assume he has a significant online footprint. How did he talk to other gamers? What did he Google? Hmm. What kind of websites did he read? So there's a lot of information you can access. But the second piece of this answer is, when you contrast a single player versus a conspiracy, conspiracies typically you have people talking among themselves and they will have a rationale that we can comprehend. When you're dealing with a singleton, one conspirator, the likelihood that you can really understand what's going on into one human's head who may not have a really rational view of the world, I think is lower. So he might speak, we might get access to data, but that still doesn't mean that his rationale is going to make a heck of a lot of sense.
Okay, and that leads to another thing, and that's the conspiracy theories. Ryan Lucas mentioned them. One of the theories was promoted by Dan Bongino before he was at the FBI. When he was a commentator, he described the pipe bombs as an inside job. I just want to underline this based on what we know. Any evidence that this person was an insider or that this was an inside job?
No, and I can give you evidence against that. Every time I heard this when I was in the inside, it would make me laugh, because if you're talking about 5 years of investigations, you're talking about hundreds and thousands of people involved in those investigations. Not only the agents, but the analysts looking through things like phone data and credit card data, the scientists down at Quantico looking at the device. If you want to believe it's an inside job, you've got to believe there are a conspiracy among hundreds or thousands of people, all of whom decided not to tell the world that this was really conducted by the FBI. That beggars belief. That just doesn't happen.
And what questions do you still have as we get this case into court and maybe learn a little bit more over time?
Boy, I did this for a living. My question is going back to where we were a couple years ago, and that is, how are new data analysis programs able to crack cases that we would have had a hard time with 15 years ago? That is really interesting.
Phil Mudd is a former deputy director of the CIA Counterterrorist Center and also as deputy director of the FBI National Security Branch. Mr. Mudd, thanks so much.
Thank you.
After two West Virginia National Guard members were shot while on patrol in Washington, D.C., some in West Virginia are questioning the entire deployment. Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom was killed. Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolfe remains in critical condition. NPR's Scott Newman reports from their hometowns.
On most weekday mornings at Vicky's Restaurant in Webster Springs, the town of about 800 where Army Specialist Sarah Beckstrom grew up, you'll find school bus driver Kenny Kidd. For many years, he was Beckstrom's ride to school.
She was a great kid. Always had a smile on her face, always willing to help, and always liked to give me a rough time.
Kidd's heard the reports that the West Virginia Guard is spending most of its time doing landscaping and picking up trash in Washington, D.C., rather than restoring order.
They're not doing their job up there.
West Virginia is a deeply red state, but it's not hard to find people who agree with Kidd. On a freezing morning, Rosanna Groves is waiting for the Quarter store to open. It's a used clothing store where everything costs a quarter. Groves is related by marriage to the Beckstroms. She also doesn't understand the point of the West Virginia Guard being in D.C.
I feel it was crazy. I really do, that they sent them there.
Republican Governor Patrick Morrissey is defending his decision to send Guard troops to Washington, D.C. at the request of the Trump administration. The deployment is voluntary. Democratic lawmakers in the state have sharply criticized Morrissey for signing off on it, and several newspaper op-eds have echoed that sentiment. NPR reached out to the governor's office for comment, but did not receive a response by airtime. But the governor's media representatives have denied reports that the Guard was being used for cleanup work. About 4.5 hours north along winding mountain roads is Martinsburg, West Virginia, where Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolfe is from. Berkeley County Commissioner John Hardy is one of many in the community who showed up for a prayer vigil on his behalf. Hardy says there are always questions when people are put in harm's way.
There was a mission to be done, and that mission was being done, and unfortunately this is just something that, a senseless act that happened.
As people try to understand this senseless act, they hope and pray that Staff Sergeant Wolfe will make it home. Scott Newman, NPR News, Martinsburg, West Virginia.
This is NPR News.
One of the big stories of the morning is who is purchasing Warner Brothers. We're probably familiar with the company. It's a Bay Area-based company. More on that story is on the way next as Morning Edition continues here on KQED News. In about a half an hour or so, Marketplace Morning Report. Is it ethical to mine the moon? A conversation coming up on the Marketplace Morning Report on the consequences of the fast-growing lunar industry. That's ahead at 7:51 on KQED News. Michael State in for Sandy Althaus. It's now 7:20. That's traffic check time. Good morning, Mel Baker.
In Campbell, Highway 17 northbound before Hamilton Avenue, a middle lane blocked by a traffic hazard. In the North Bay in Novato, 101 southbound between Highway 37 and North San Pedro Road is beginning to slow. In San Rafael, 101 northbound's off-ramp to Central San Rafael is partially blocked by a hazard in the left lane. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. More updates, another update, pardon me, with Mel right before the bottom of the hour. KQED News with Brian Watt. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. KQED News, ahead at 8:22, California has mandated cities build new housing to address the affordability crisis. In response, San Francisco is now moving forward with a rezoning plan. The impact is apparently going to be felt especially in residential neighborhoods. Details on that and other stories ahead at 8:22 on KQED News. Forum at 9 o'clock. How much do you plan to spend on holiday gifts this year? It could be more than last year as prices rise in a trend that some are calling giftflation. Hear more on Forum this morning at 9 here on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in theaters everywhere. Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And the listeners and sustaining members, just like you, of KQED News at 7:22.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Netflix this morning announced a deal to buy one of Hollywood's top companies, Warner Brothers Discovery. It's valued at around $80 billion. Netflix is already a dominant player, and this would create an entertainment and streaming behemoth. CNN and other cable channels owned by Warner Brothers are not part of the deal and will be spun off. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here on a snowy Friday to tell us more. He's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us more about this deal.
Well, it's an enormous deal. You're seeing Netflix take in essentially HBO streaming service and absorb all of Warner Brothers' past IP and the archives of their film. You think of franchises like Marvel. It's supersizing what was already the dominant player in Hollywood.
You were telling me earlier that this changes the contours of Hollywood. Can you say more about that?
Well, Netflix clearly is showing it wants to be the Amazon of entertainment. It also has had over the years a strong corporate ethos that we don't buy, we make. We do things ourselves. We may acquire individual projects, but we're not buying, you know, huge studios and things like that. And this one, they're saying, we're going to go all in here. We want to block others from maybe being able to compete with us as much. We want to be a dominant force as well, both in terms of talent and in terms of the intellectual property, but also in terms of reaching the streamers and the consumers. Let's not forget, Netflix is already the world's largest streaming service. Here they say, well, we're going to be a mega studio as well.
You know, we've been hearing for weeks, I mean, people who follow the trades, right, which is not everybody, but we've been hearing for weeks that the Ellisons, the billionaires, Larry and David, who owned Paramount Global, had the inside track to buy all of Warner Brothers Discovery. So do you know anything about, like, what happened? How big of a surprise is this?
Well, until I'd say about 48, 72 hours ago, it would be a complete shock, in part because of Netflix's predilection, and maybe they want to do it, but they tend to be disposed not, and in part because Paramount was sending all the body language. This is ours for the taking. They have an inside deal to the Trump White House, which is, you know, political considerations are important, which we can talk about in a moment. They also have the money. Larry Ellison, you know, the co-founder of Oracle is one of the few most wealthy people on the planet. They've got billions to spend. They want to combine it with Paramount, the parent company of CBS, Paramount Streaming, to take on Netflix, to compete with them. And Netflix swoops in and just buys the elements that are clearly profitable. It's leaving hanging in the balance, as we saw happen through Comcast divesting itself of MSNBC and other cable channels very recently. It's leaving these more precarious so-called linear channels their future in the balance, and it's taking the ones that are clearly the future and what's going to be the profits. The Ellisons had basically said this is going to be ours. Then in recent days, you saw David Ellison withdraw from an appearance at New York Times Deal Book on Wednesday. And you saw them send a note to the board basically saying, we're going to challenge and perhaps make a hostile takeover bid if they go in a different direction, signaling they were worried that they weren't getting a fair deal.
Very briefly, like all big deals, this has to go through antitrust review. How likely is this to go through?
I think it's a real question. You know, Trump has indicated he's populist, but really it's a question of who's in and who's out. The Ellisons are very much in favor at the White House right now, and yet there is plenty of reason to challenges on antitrust grounds. Not only a question of the studios doing businesses or filmmakers having to do business with Netflix, but individual consumers having to pay potentially more for this combined HBO-Netflix deal. You could see State Attorney General. You could see the Justice Department taking real issues there.
That is NPR's David Fulkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
It's time now for StoryCorps. Marla Wendell was 3 months pregnant in the early 1990s when she had a stroke. It affected her motor skills and memory. She still delivered a healthy son, Daniel, who's now 32 years old. They came to StoryCorps in Chicago.
A lot of time went by between when you had your stroke and when I was born. What were you thinking during that time?
I was just thinking, we're going to make it. We're going to make it. At one point when I was pregnant, they were like, are you going to terminate the baby or not? It's risky to continue for your health, for the baby's health. And I was like, of course, we're going to keep the baby.
And you have so much trouble making decisions about everything under the sun.
I know.
So you have trouble deciding what breakfast cereal.
I know, I do. I do. That is true. But I felt so strongly you were supposed to be here. I was just thinking, like, I want to be your mother. I want to be your mother so bad.
Do you want to tell us about the stroke?
It was a Saturday night. As the night progressed, I noticed my leg was giving out, and you have an older sibling, so I started thinking, like, I've got to get him into bed, and I feel bad, but I heaved him into the cage.
You meant crib, right?
Oh, what'd I say?
Cage.
I did. Yes, thank you.
You know, I was probably a teenager before I realized that not everyone has traumatic brain injuries, and that's not just some fun game me and my mom play when she forgets words. But I always knew that you risked your life so that I could come into this world. That was always in the background.
You had said that it made you feel pressured.
Yeah, but pressure to do amazing things with your life, that's not a bad thing.
Yes, but I never want amazing things like become the president of the United States or go to the moon. But like that you would bring joy to people because you have such a kind heart and you're such a good person.
I mean, I had a pretty good example.
That's good to hear. Thanks, Len. You're so strong inside, and if people see you, they might not know that because you're so quiet and thoughtful. If you weren't here with us, the world would not be as good of a place. Really, truly. I can't think of it. It was a miracle that the two of us made it.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Just ahead, a KQED news update with Brian Watt, and then it's more Morning Edition on a Friday ahead as well. At 7:29, traffic check time, beginning with a problem in Pleasanton with Mel Baker.
580 eastbound before Hacienda Drive, the right lane blocked by a three-car crash. It is stop and go back to Hop Yard Road. Meanwhile, 580 westbound in Castro Valley before Castro Valley Boulevard, some tire tread is in the left lane. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Traffic support comes from Shanyun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Good Earth Natural Foods, serving the Marin community with organic holiday meals, turkeys, and more, with locations in Fairfax and Mill Valley, and now offering curbside pickup and delivery. Learn more at genatural.com. And visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. Good morning, now 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Teachers and administrators from West Contra Costa Unified School District briefly returned to negotiations yesterday, hours after teachers went on strike over pay and benefits. District officials are calling those talks productive. In the superintendent's words, we are making our way forward. But union leaders say the session was short, the district did not provide a meaningful proposal, and no new talks are planned. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara was at a rally yesterday outside district headquarters in Richmond.
Veterans Memorial Park, located in front of the district's headquarters, was blanketed in red and yellow from union members' signs and shirts. Juana Aguirre is a teacher's aide. She said she sees the negative effect of short staffing on her students and on her own third grade son in the district.
We don't have the help that we deserve, especially with our students that need the most help. And they also need a smaller class so they can get the support that they need.
Union officials said they're willing to strike as long as necessary to secure proper pay and benefit increases. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
Meanwhile, some West Contra Costa elementary school students are joining their teachers on the picket line. KQED's Eliza Pepple has that part of the story.
The energy was high at Madera Elementary School in El Cerrito, where teachers, parents, and students under 10 years old picketed with upbeat music and homemade signs.
Hey, hey, ho, ho. There's an alderman,
a porta potty stood outside the school to help keep strikers from crossing the picket line. Raylene Coburn has worked at the school for 3 years as an attendance clerk and says tensions over pay and benefits coverage have been building throughout that time. She's moved by the students' willingness to participate.
That is the most uplifting thing ever, to see that kids are not crossing the picket line. Their parents are bringing them here instead. They've made their own signs. I've been taking pictures all morning. And they care. They understand. Young minds know what's going on. You just need to give them a chance to learn, and they understand what we're up against.
AJ Larson is one of them. His mom, Mary, works at the school.
I'm AJ, and I like school.
Though the school remains open, along with others in the district, teacher Maria Salvate said only a few kids had entered the school by mid-morning. I'm Eliza Pepple, KQED News.
Claude the albino alligator will remain part of San Francisco's California Academy of Sciences even after his death earlier this week. KQED's Catherine Monahan explains.
The last few weeks have been tough for Academy staff who cared for Claude as he got sicker, and now they have another difficult task, to preserve his remains and his memory. Claude's skull and parts of his hide will be prepared as museum specimens and become part of the herpetology collection. And aquarium director Bart Shepard says they may also create a statue of the alligator.
He was such a charismatic and iconic resident and connected with so many millions of people. I think folks will want some sort of touch point, you know, to remember him with.
Claude's enclosure is currently empty, except for a few turtles. Shepard says it may become home to another alligator, but not right away. I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. In 10 minutes, we'll talk about the San Jose Sharks and why they're so exciting this season.
Support comes from Postmate, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. And more is at postman.com. Clear to partly cloudy, chilly temperatures this morning. Areas of frost and patchy, possibly dense fog as well. Then becoming sunny the rest of the day. Highs this Friday, mid-50s to low-60s for the Bay Area. And southern Sacramento Valley, a dense fog advisory in effect till later this morning. Highs today under mostly cloudy skies with possibility of fog in spots, locally dense, highs 50 to 57. Support for NPR comes from Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And the listeners of KQED News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. A powerful federal committee is trying again today to change how children get vaccinated against infectious diseases. The panel was supposed to vote on those changes yesterday, and they did not, as the meeting descended into chaos and confusion instead. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us. Rob, good morning.
Good morning.
So what happened?
Well, you know, as you said, it turned into quite a spectacle. The meeting lasted all day, but participants repeatedly interrupted and talked over each other, sometimes even snapping curtly in frustration. Let's listen to one exchange. At the end of the day, Dr. Joseph Hiblin was talking about how the committee was evaluating the science, but then he got into it with Dr. Robert Malone, who was chairing the meeting.
If we don't have a scientific framework, they are susceptible to
And we have heard your comments,
so,
and please understand
that there
is a process in place.
Please do not interrupt me.
And you know, Steve, that kind of typified how the day went.
Would you just remind us what it was the committee was supposed to be deciding?
Yeah. This committee, it's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It's considering changing the way children get vaccinated against hepatitis B, dropping a recommendation that all kids get the shot within 24 hours of being born. This protects them from getting chronically infected with hepatitis B and getting liver disease, liver failure, and maybe even liver cancer later in life. And it's been very successful. Hepatitis B infections have plummeted in the U.S. since universal routine vaccination began.
And we heard a doctor on the program yesterday who was arguing that getting that vaccination right at the beginning, right at birth, is really important. So
yeah.
Why would the committee even consider changing that?
Well, this committee was handpicked by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has long questioned many vaccines. And some members of this committee argued that there's insufficient evidence that giving all newborns the hepatitis B vaccine when they're so young is necessary and safe. After several hours of presentations and sometimes heated debate, the committee seemed poised to recommend dropping that universal recommendation and replacing it with a recommendation that only babies whose mothers test positive for the hepatitis B virus or whose status is unknown always get the shot at birth. That's a change most public health experts say would be a terrible mistake. But just as the committee was getting close to voting, the chairman suddenly announced that they would vote on three questions instead of two, and he didn't even have a slide he could put up so committee members could see exactly how they were answering some pretty complicated questions. So more frustration and confusion ensued. Here's Dr. Hiblin again.
Trying to evaluate a moving target, and we don't even have a slide explicitly describing what questions we're supposed to answer.
And the majority of the committee agreed that they didn't really understand what they were voting on, so they voted to postpone a decision.
Until today?
That's right. The committee's going to try once again after clarifying the exact language of the recommendations, and then they'll turn to other possible big changes to the rest of the childhood vaccine schedule, which have protected kids against measles, whooping cough, and polio, and more than a dozen other dangerous infections for decades.
NPR Health correspondent Rob Stein, thanks.
You bet, Steve.
Let's turn to a physician who previously served as the CDC's chief medical officer. Dr. Deborah Howry worked for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for more than a decade. She resigned in August, along with some other colleagues, in protest of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy's changes at the agency, later testifying before a Senate panel that Kennedy was, quote, censoring science. And she's with us now. Dr. Howry, good morning.
Good morning.
You just heard our colleague Rob Stein describe this chaotic meeting. I know you watched it also. What did you make of it?
You know, it's disappointing and really concerning when, you know, lives are at stake and this is about vaccines. And this committee met in September and couldn't get their act together and postponed it to December. So surely, you know, over 3 months, they should know what they're voting on and the evidence, or they shouldn't be having these discussions.
There's been a lot of criticism of this panel of advisors, their credentials or their lack thereof, including from at least one Republican, Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, on X Thursday called the committee, quote, totally discredited. And I do want to mention Cassidy is also a physician. Do you share his opinion?
Yeah. You know, when you look at the ACIP members, the immunization practice committee members, usually they are, pediatricians, people with vaccine science, pharmacologists. Many of these people don't have that deep science background. And when you looked at the presenters yesterday, what was unusual is usually you have CDC scientists really getting deep into the data. Instead, you had people, including two that had a retracted paper on autism, presenting on vaccine safety who aren't vaccine safety scientists.
I noted that you posted a piece on Time this morning on their website saying that Congress really needs to step in here. But what could they do?
Yeah, they could do a few things, not just around the vaccine committee, but CDC continues to hire political appointees. There are now over 14 of them with no career scientists in the office of the director. I left 100 days ago, and there are still no career scientists really providing any direction. If you look at oversight over things like the vaccine committee meeting, they could ensure that the committee's following processes like posting documents and data in advance of the committees, you know, ensuring the vote language is open to the public, ensuring good representation. So Congress could do a lot.
So just getting back to the question of vaccines, the CDC can choose not to follow the panel's recommendations, but if it does follow them, what are you most concerned about, this recommendation against vaccinating all newborns again against hepatitis B?
Yeah, and, you know, the CDC could choose not to follow them, but the acting CDC director is RFK's deputy secretary, and the secretary could, of course, choose to do what he wants. So I would believe that whatever the vaccine committee does, CDC and the department will follow. But if, you know, they decide not to allow this shot at 2 months, they're taking the choice away from parents. Parents should be able to decide to protect their own newborns from lifelong liver disease. So I would be concerned if they take that choice away.
So if parents are concerned and want to opt into the vaccine, can they do that?
It'll depend on the vote. If they say shared decision making, then parents would still be able to do it. If they say only if you are positive for hepatitis, then that choice is taken away. And parents should have that right to protect their kids. We already know, you know, that thousands and thousands of liver diseases were averted when the hepatitis vaccine began being given at birth to everybody, because there's household exposures, nail clippings, like all sorts of things that can expose a newborn, even if the mom doesn't have hepatitis. So this is about protecting babies and giving parents the choice to do that.
That's Dr. Deborah Howery. She's the former chief medical officer for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She resigned in August. Doctor, thank you so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
743 KQED News is next. Brian Watt will have an update on what's up with the San Jose Sharks. Kind of an up-and-down season so far for them and some of their very, very young players. More ahead. And then Marketplace Morning Report comes your way in about 9 minutes from now. Is it ethical to mine the moon? You'll hear a conversation coming up on the consequences of the fast-growing lunar industry. Marketplace Morning Report also, they have the latest on the big Netflix Warner Brothers deal announced this morning. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althouse. Traffic time with Mel Baker beginning in Rodeo.
80 eastbound after Rodeo. The two left lanes are blocked by a multi-vehicle crash. Traffic is slowing back to Highway 4. The Richmond-San Rafael Bridge back up, not quite as bad as it was. It's around Cutting Boulevard to the toll plaza. It's sluggish all the way across the span to Sir Francis Drake Boulevard. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, custom home builders. Support for KQED comes from the Parks Conservancy, partner of the National Park Service and Presidio Trust, protecting 82,000 acres of national parklands from Marin to San Mateo. Learn how to give and how to get involved at parksconservancy.org. And the San Francisco Symphony, where listeners can join the symphony to ring in the holidays with festive concerts throughout December. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday.
It's been a heavy year in the news, but at NPR, we always find time for a break.
Earlier this week, we reported on octopuses. Octopi?
A chance to dish with a friend.
Everything comes back to Love Island.
Love Island, everything. Or a quick nosh.
I mean, warm and potatoey on the inside and then the hint of onion. Oh.
Give back to the station that brings you joy and wonder, along with the news, by making your gift today.
Give at kqed.org/donate. The Trump administration's immigration crackdown has affected communities up and down California. For those who are deported, they are often missing friends, family, and their longtime pets. I'm Erin Baldessari. We'll hear about one man's long journey to be reunited with his dog, Chapo. That story and more coming up on the California Report.
Yeah, that's ahead, 8:51 on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from your part-time controller specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay. A new comedy from James L. Brooks starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. And support comes from you, the listeners and sustaining members of KQED News. Good morning. It's 7:46.
It's morning edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. The San Jose Sharks are on the road for the next week, starting tonight in Dallas. So far this hockey season, the Sharks are keeping us guessing. Just this week, they got a mammoth win over Utah, followed by a capital loss to Washington. But if the present seems a little uncertain, the Sharks have some young talent that make the future look amazing. 19-year-old Macklin Celebrini is scoring goals at a crazy clip, maybe even like the Steph Curry of hockey. Dieter Kurtenbach wrote a column about this for the Bay Area News Group, and he joins us. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, like, what is Macklin Celebrini doing on the ice that has you thinking about Steph Curry?
He is 19 years old, and he is unquestionably one of the best players in the NHL and playing a style of hockey that is conducive to winning and for the San Jose Sharks for fundamentally changing the trajectory of a franchise. This is a guy who was drafted number one overall 2 years ago. When he has the puck on his stick and he is skating through everybody and he's firing off wrist shots that look like they're going 300 miles per hour, it's jaw-dropping. I mean, everybody in the crowd at the Shark Tanks SAP Center in San Jose, they gasp when he gets the puck. And the only comparison I can make to that is when Steph Curry puts up a three-point shot. And I haven't felt this way towards an athlete in Bay Area sports since Steph Curry really came into his own as an MVP caliber player.
I have read that Macklin Celebrini's father, Rick, is the director of sports medicine and performance of mm-hmm. the Warriors. So yep. there's another connection to Steph Curry. But right. but what else do we know about him? Where did he come from?
Well, he grew up in what is apparently the new hotbed of hockey in the world, which is the suburban Vancouver area. But he has been a known entity for a very long time, played with the Chicago Steel and junior hockey. Again, Boston University, plays 1 year there and then is the number one overall pick. And last year, a little bit of growing pains in his rookie season for the Sharks. He was an 18-year-old kid going up against millionaire 30-year-old men who play a very physical brand of hockey in the NHL. And he figured it out as the season went along, and now he is just dominating.
I mean, are we getting into, like, potential Wayne Gretzky territory here?
Absolutely. He is doing things that have not been done since Wayne Gretzky. When we're talking about the amount of production in terms of points, which are goals plus assists, and his age. And we're in kind of a golden or a new generation is really coming up in hockey right now. Not just Macklin Celebrini, but Connor Bedard, who went number one the year before him. Leo Carlson, who plays for the Sharks' rival, the Anaheim Ducks, was the number two pick in 2023.
Let's be fair here. You yeah. have written about another young Shark. Celebrini is yeah. not the only young Shark. Will Smith, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you say he should be on the USA Olympic team.
Will Smith, if he was on any other team, in the situation that the San Jose Sharks have been in now for the last 5 years, right? Tearing it down to the studs, rebuilding around young talent. If any other team was in that situation and they had Will Smith, this playmaker extraordinaire, he'd be the centerpiece of it all. They'd be building the whole operation around Will Smith. He himself is a borderline, if not already there, superstar player, one of the 30 best scorers in the NHL right now. Celebrini and Smith have the makings of the kind of duo that wins Stanley Cups. There's still some work to be done, to be sure, but the Sharks are in a great position, not just to win now, but to win really, really big in the future.
Dieter Kurtenbach, sports columnist for the Bay Area News Group, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Marketplace Morning Report just ahead here on KQED News at 7:50 or 10 before 8. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus. With a check of traffic beginning in the North Bay, here's Mel Baker.
In Novato, 101 southbound just after DeLong Avenue, a two-vehicle crash is blocking the right lane. 101 southbound through the area is stacked up between Highway 37 and North San Pedro Road. We have this coastal flood advisory in effect through Sunday or early into Monday. The lower half of the Manzanita Park and Ride lot in Mill Valley and the shoulder of parking along Shoreline Highway are all closed through Monday due to those flooding conditions. Mel Baker for KQED.
Yeah, coastal flood advisory is in effect through at least Sunday afternoon. Thanks, Mel. Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Mel with the latest in traffic right before the top of the hour. NPR and KQED News. Traffic support, as I mentioned, comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite.
China is at the cutting edge of technologies that reimagine transportation. Self-driving cars are only the beginning.
Local governments are very aggressive to promote new technology to serve the public here.
Get a look at the future of transportation from inside China. That is next time on The World.
That's this afternoon beginning at 2, followed by the PBS NewsHour this afternoon at 3 on KQED News. You know, a donor-advised fund is one of the most tax-efficient ways to give. Maximize your charitable impact by recommending a grant to KQED to support the public media you and your community rely on. Learn more by going to kqed.org/DAF. kqed.org/DAF. And thank you. 7:51 at KQED News.
Can a Hollywood studio get too big?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. There's news this morning that Netflix is buying Warner Brothers Discovery in a deal worth more than $82 billion. Today's announcement comes after a fierce bidding war, and there could still be more twists and turns, as is Hollywood style. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Netflix says the deal will close after Warner Brothers Discovery finishes spinning off its cable channels, including CNN. Netflix expects this to happen in the third quarter of next year. On an investor call this morning, Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos said the company can't stand still.
We need to keep innovating and investing in stories that matter most to audiences. And that's what this deal is all about.
The deal still has to be approved by regulators. Some lawmakers are already raising antitrust concerns. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa of California wrote a letter to the Justice Department. He says if Netflix and Warner Brothers combined, they'd control more than 30% of the streaming market, a threshold he says is, quote, traditionally viewed as presumptively problematic under antitrust law. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Warner Brothers stock is up 3.2%. Netflix is down slightly. A first reading on consumer sentiment for December shows a slight increase over government shutdown tainted November, but the University of Michigan survey finds pessimism running much higher than the levels we saw at the start of this year. The Fed is expected to lower interest rates slightly next week at a time that it's especially hard to tell if it's inflation or a flagging job market that's the most pressing problem. The Dow is up 195 points, 0.4%. The S&P up 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 0.6%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking. Exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com. And by the United States Postal Service, offering holiday stamps for purchase at over 40,000 supermarkets and drugstores, and at wholesale clubs Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's.
Orlando. A few weeks ago, the Economist magazine people convened what was called the Space Economy Summit. Houston, a few weeks earlier, it was the Lunar and Mars Economy Summit. There's no economy on the moon now, right? But governments and private companies are hard at work to change that. This week on this program, we've been looking at opportunities on the moon and potential costs. We've heard from a moon economist and two companies laying the plumbing for a lunar economy. But what should be the guardrails? Mary Jane Rubenstein is Dean of Social Sciences and a Professor of Religion and Science and Technology Studies at Wesleyan University. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I was going to ask, when we think about an emerging lunar economy, you know, who owns the moon? But then, you know, I found the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which seems to ban private ownership of celestial bodies. Is it a settled matter?
Well, it is settled and it is not settled. It is settled insofar as over 100 major nations have signed on to the Outer Space Treaty, which dictates, as you've said, that nobody can own part or all of a planetary body. It is not settled insofar as the U.S. recently, in 2015 in particular, has passed legislation arguing that citizens, by which they mean corporations, can in fact own the materials that they recover from a lunar body. So you can't own part of the moon, but you can own the stuff that the moon contains.
All right. Well, that brings us right to mining and the rules that might apply if they find something of value that they would like to extract on the moon. What protocols might guide that?
It's actually not clear whether or not ownership is guaranteed or protected. And so that is going to be worked out in the courts, and it'll be worked out on the lunar surface, really.
Yeah, and that gets us to, you know, who would get to do that? That would be the fastest and the mightiest, the country or group or interest that gets there first and can defend the perimeter.
That's right. So there are plenty of nations that object to the way that the U.S. and some of the other larger nations have gone about making unilateral legislation on these matters. But those tend to be non-spacefaring nations. And the rules, it seems, are going to be set by those nations that can make it up there and set policy as they go.
You could just imagine a private interest wanting to build a big structure on the lunar surface that would be visible from Earth, like a perpetual piece of advertising. Someone might object to that.
A couple of years ago, when a mission, a privately funded mission, intended to deposit human remains on the lunar surface in a kind of ritual burial, and the Navajo Nation objected to this and said, you can't just do whatever you want on the surface of the moon. And these corporations said, yes, we absolutely can. And the Navajo Nation appealed to NASA, and NASA said, we don't have any control over private corporations. So we are in this age where private actors in a fairly unregulated fashion are able to pursue all kinds of interests without much oversight and over the objections of many other actors.
As humans map out what the rules might be for using the moon, I mean, as you think about the ethics of answering that question, I mean, one thing that would come to mind would be one hopes it's a transparent process.
I think one of the major impediments to that openness is that there is no operative relationship between the U.S. and China when it comes to space matters. It's almost seen as an imperative to maintain some kind of secrecy in order to rival China, to make sure that the U.S. gets there, in order to set the rules before China does.
Mary J. Rubenstein is Dean of Social Sciences and Professor of Religion and Science and Technology Studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace Online has more of our Moon Economy series. And when we say moon, some think rockets. As a certified level 2 amateur rocketeer, I see lessons for stock market investing in the glorious successes and ignominious failures of my own launches. The video is streamable now from TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, where Marketplace APM is the way to find us. Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our digital team includes Antoinette Brock, Emily McCune, and Dylan Mietinen. Our engineers are Rachel Breeze and Tessa Block. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
7:59, traffic check time with Mel Baker, beginning with a problem in the East Bay. Mel?
In San Lorenzo, we're looking at the slowdown on southbound 880, which is slow to stop and go from I-238 all the way down to Highway 84. Westbound 92 on the San Mateo Bridge, it's stop and go from about just before the Interpretive Center to the toll plaza, but it remains slow across the span around mid-span. Traffic on the west end of the Dumbarton Bridge is also slowing. Mel Baker for KQED.
More traffic with Mel right after the top of the hour news. Support for KQED comes from the historic San Jose Civic, presenting Dave Cause and Friends Christmas Tour with special guests Jonathan Butler, Haley Reinhardt, Casey Abrams, and Kayla Waters, live on December 21st. Tickets available now at sanjosecivic.com.